Imagine checking into a major public hospital in New York City, right? You're looking at the dinner menu, and you realize that the default meal you're about to be served contains absolutely zero meat.
None at all.
Right, like no chicken broth, no beef stew. Unless you specifically request otherwise, you are getting a chef-prepared, entirely plant-based meal.
Which is, I mean, that's just a massive structural shift.
It really is. And this isn't some, you know, fringe wellness clinic or a tiny pilot program. It's the new standard operating procedure for the largest municipal healthcare system in the United States.
Yeah, and it really represents this fundamental rewiring of how global institutions are thinking about the food we eat. Because historically, dietary changes, especially anything with the word plant-based attached to it, have been framed as these very rigid, individual, binary choices.
Yeah, exactly. Like you're either a strict vegan or you're a conventional omnivore. Right.
But the data we're looking at today shows that binary is completely dissolving.
It is. And that's our mission for today. We are doing a deep dive into decoding what researchers are now calling the plant-forward transition.
I love that term.
Me too. And we've got a really formidable stack of sources for you today. We're looking at clinical studies from Harvard and The Lancet, planetary health modeling from the E.T. Lancet Commission, and major policy blueprints coming out of Europe and New York City.
It's a lot of ground to cover.
It is, but it's so fascinating. We're going to explore what plant-forward actually means in practice. We'll uncover the specific vascular mechanisms behind its impact on your heart and brain and dissect the really tricky trap of ultra-processed fake meats.
Oh, yeah. We definitely need to talk about the fake meats.
Absolutely. And then finally, we'll look at the behavioral psychology behind how global governments are, you know, actively redesigning the menus we all eat from. So, okay, let's unpack this.
Let's do it.
We need to start with the terminology, I think, because based on the frameworks from Harvard Health and the Mayo Clinic, plant-forward or plant-predominant eating is explicitly not an all-or-nothing identity.
No, not at all. The clinical research has largely abandoned the word veganism when they communicate public health strategies.
Right.
Plant-forward simply indicates a proportional shift. I mean, it just means the dietary foundation, like the bulk of your daily caloric intake, comes from fruits, vegetables, legumes, whole grains, nuts, and healthy oils.
So the plants become the anchor of the plate rather than just, you know, the sad side dish.
Exactly.
The way I like to think of it, and this really helps me visualize it, is think of your diet not as an on-off switch, but as a dimmer switch.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah, you don't have to plunge into total dietary darkness, right? You don't have to abandon every single animal product you grew up eating just to see a metabolic change. You're just sliding the dimmer switch up on plants.
Hmm. And what's fascinating here is that the scientific literature is actually adapting to measure that exact dimmer switch.
Really? How so?
Well, our stack includes studies that explicitly quantify flexitarian or vegetarian-ish eating patterns. Mm. And measuring this flexibility is vital because of the behavioral psychology involved.
Okay, walk us through that.
When a dietary intervention requires the absolute total elimination of a beloved food group, it triggers an immediate scarcity mindset in the patient.
Oh, for sure. Tell someone they're permanently banned from eating cheese, and their brain will suddenly prioritize cheese above all other thoughts.
Right. I mean, the psychological friction is immense, but framing the transition as a proportional increase in whole plant foods bypasses that barrier entirely.
Because you're adding, not subtracting.
Exactly. It transforms the concept of dietary change from this restrictive, temporary crash diet into a highly sustainable habit.
So you still have your traditional Thanksgiving turkey.
Yeah, you keep the turkey, but you might turn the dimmer switch up by making your Tuesday night dinner a hearty lentil stew.
Hmm.
The flexibility is what creates long-term compliance.
Okay, so if we slide that dimmer switch up on plants, what are the actual mechanics of the payoff inside the body? Because there's a standout finding from a Harvard study, this was reported in the Washington Post, that puts a very specific number on this.
Yeah, this study was incredible.
They found that consuming a diet rich in high-quality plant-based foods during midlife is strongly correlated with reaching the age of 70 entirely free of major chronic diseases.
Which is huge. Reaching 70 without cardiovascular disease, without type 2 diabetes, and without severe cognitive decline is a remarkable public health benchmark.
It really is.
And to understand the mechanism, we have to look at what these specific plant foods are doing to your vascular system. It's really a two-part equation.
Okay, what are the two parts?
It's about the damage you are actively avoiding and the repair you are facilitating.
Well, the American Heart Association data in our stack zeroes in on that first part, the avoiding damage. They highlight that
exactly. Animal fats like butter or lard are heavily saturated, and at a molecular level, saturated fat chains are perfectly straight, which allows them to pack really tightly together.
Oh, which is why butter is a solid block at room temperature.
You got it. And inside your bloodstream, a high intake of these saturated fats promotes the buildup of low-density lipoproteins, or LDL cholesterol.
The bad cholesterol.
Right. And that LDL forms the rigid plaques that narrow your arteries and trigger those dangerous clots we were talking about.
Whereas the plant oils are basically doing the mechanical opposite.
Yeah, because plant oils are predominantly unsaturated fats. Their molecular chains literally have kinks in them, which prevents them from packing tightly.
So they stay liquid.
Exactly. They stay liquid at room temperature. And when you substitute them for saturated fats, these unsaturated fats actively improve your blood cholesterol ratios. They enhance endothelial function.
Endothelial meaning the inner lining of the blood vessels.
Yes, meaning that inner lining remains flexible and resilient. You are fundamentally changing the structural integrity of your cardiovascular system just by changing the fat you cook with.
Wow. And that improved vascular flexibility is exactly what protects the brain over time, too, right?
Huh.
Because cognitive health is essentially downstream of cardiovascular health.
100%. The brain is a massive consumer of oxygen and nutrients, which makes it incredibly sensitive to blood flow and systemic inflammation.
Right.
So the Harvard research linking high-quality plant diets to a lower risk of dementia, it relies heavily on preventing what we call oxidative stress.
Okay. Let's pause and define that for the listener.
Yeah.
Because oxidative stress is one of those terms that gets thrown around a lot in, like, wellness influencer circles without much explanation of what it actually is.
Yeah, it sounds like a buzzword. But simply put, as your cells generate energy, they produce these unstable molecules called free radicals.
Kind of like cellular exhaust fumes.
That is a perfect analogy. Yes, cellular exhaust. And if you don't have enough antioxidants to neutralize that exhaust, those free radicals bounce around and literally damage your cells and your DNA.
Okay.
That is oxidative stress. And over decades, it degrades brain tissue. Now, plants are uniquely dense in antioxidants and specific compounds called phytochemicals.
Phytochemicals being the defense compounds that plants produce to protect themselves from, like the sun and pests, right?
Correct. And here is the really cool part. When we consume those plants, those phytochemicals act as powerful signaling molecules in the human body.
So they go to work for us.
Exactly. They neutralize the free radicals and actively dampen the inflammatory pathways that accelerate cognitive decline.
That is amazing. And this whole chemical exchange brings us to the gut. I mean, I know you listening are probably well aware of the gut microbiome and the trillions of bacteria living in the digestive tract.
It's a very popular topic right now.
Definitely. But the PubMed study in our stack dives into the specific mechanical dependency those bacteria have on plant-forward eating. And it all centers on fermentation.
Yes. The fermentation of plant fiber is basically the engine of human gut health.
Because we can't digest it ourselves.
Right. Human digestive enzymes cannot break down certain complex carbohydrates found in plants. So those intact fibers travel all the way down to your large intestine, where your gut bacteria use them as their primary food source.
It's a buffet down there for them.
Yeah.
And the byproduct of that bacterial feast is what actually matters to our immune system.
Precisely. The bacteria ferment the plant fiber and produce these things called short-chain fatty acids, primarily butyrate, acetate, and propionate.
Okay, butyrate. I've heard of that one.
Yeah, butyrate is huge. These short-chain fatty acids are the primary energy source for the cells lining your colon. They actively repair the mucosal barrier, which prevents pathogens from leaking into your bloodstream.
Leaky gut, essentially.
Exactly. And they also serve as chemical messengers that regulate the immune response throughout your entire body.
But meat and dairy don't have this fiber.
Meat, dairy, and eggs contain absolutely zero fiber. So a diet dominated by animal products physically starves those beneficial bacteria, which completely halts the production of those critical short-chain fatty acids.
Okay, I want to pause here and talk about macronutrients. Because if I'm tracking my macros, you know, trying to maintain muscle mass, the immediate cultural instinct is to grab a chicken breast.
Of course.
So where does a bowl of lentils fit into that equation for the listener who is sitting there worried about hitting a protein target?
Right, the protein question. Well, the clinical data from the American Heart Association confirms that legumes, beans, lentils, nuts, and soy easily meet human daily protein requirements.
Easily?
Yes, easily. The difference really lies in the delivery mechanism. When you isolate protein from a chicken breast, you are getting a very dense hit of amino acid, sure, but you're also getting zero fiber and a measurable dose of saturated fat.
It's a package deal.
Exactly, it's a package deal. A bowl of lentils is a completely different package. You still receive the necessary amino acids, but they are bundled with a massive dose of that microbiome-feeding fiber we just discussed.
Right.
Along with complex carbohydrates that provide sustained, stable blood sugar and a really high concentration of minerals like magnesium and iron.
So you're getting more bang for your buck nutritionally.
You are. The prevailing idea that humans require massive quantities of animal-derived protein to maintain lean mass is honestly a cultural artifact, not a physiological mandate.
But, and this is big, but the very concept of the package deal is where this transition gets incredibly complicated, because our sources raise a massive red flag regarding the modern food industry.
They certainly do.
Just because a product is made entirely of plants does not automatically make it a healthy package.
No. The trap of ultra-processed foods is probably the single biggest confounding variable in plant-based nutrition research today.
My favorite way to think about this, and I tell people this all the time, a 2-liter bottle of soda is completely plant-based, but that doesn't mean it belongs in the vegetable crisper.
That is a brilliant way to put it.
Right. And we are seeing an absolute explosion of hyper-palatable plant-based meat alternatives in grocery aisles right now. Burgers that perfectly mimic the bleeding texture of beef, or chicken nuggets engineered from soy protein isolate.
They're everywhere. But the studies we reviewed from Nature Medicine and University College London draw a very, very harsh dividing line between a minimally processed plant diet and an ultra-processed one.
The clinical outcomes are night and day.
Completely. The research clearly indicates that the metabolic benefits of a plant-forward diet, like that drastic reduction in type 2 diabetes risk we talked about, are heavily dependent on the consumption of whole staples.
Whole foods.
Right. We're talking about intact beans, whole oats, unprocessed vegetables.
And that's because what happens to the physical structure of the food during manufacturing, isn't it?
Yes, the concept of the food matrix is absolutely critical here. In a whole food, the nutrients are bound within a complex cellular structure.
So like eating a whole almond.
Perfect example. When you eat an intact almond, your body has to work physically and enzymatically to break down those cell walls. That slows down digestion and keeps you satiated.
It takes effort.
Exactly. But when food is ultra-processed, that physical matrix is entirely obliterated. The fiber is either stripped away entirely or just pulverized into dust.
So even if an engineered plant-based burger boasts the exact same grams of protein as a beef burger, the body digests it completely differently.
Yes, it hits the bloodstream much, much faster. And furthermore, to replicate the mouthfeel and the juiciness of animal fat, manufacturers frequently load these products with refined coconut oil,
which is saturated fat,
exceptionally high in saturated fat, along with massive amounts of sodium.
So basically, swapping a traditional fast food burger for a highly processed fake meat fast food burger is not going to yield that midlife health boost or protect your vascular flexibility.
Not at all. The metabolic processing of those fake meats is distressingly similar to the processing of standard junk food.
Wow.
The European Journal of Clinical Nutrition study demonstrated that the cardiovascular protection associated with plant diets is primarily driven by maintaining a lower overall fat mass.
Okay, that makes sense.
And you maintain a lower fat mass by eating whole, satiating foods that naturally regulate your appetite, not by consuming hyper-refined plant isolates designed in a lab to be addictive.
There is a fascinating compromise mentioned in the Washington Post coverage, though. Because sensory data proves that taste and texture remain the biggest hurdles for people.
Oh, absolutely. People genuinely enjoy the sensory experience of meat.
Yeah, they do. And food technologists have developed these blended meats as kind of a physiological and psychological bridge.
The blended product strategy is actually quite elegant. It combines conventional meat with whole plant ingredients, usually things like mushrooms or textured soy, within a single product.
So, for instance, a burger patty formulated to be 50% beef and 50% finely chopped mushrooms.
Exactly. And it delivers the exact umami flavor profile and texture the consumer expects, but it instantly cuts the saturated fat intake and the environmental footprint in half.
It is the dimmer switch, literally engineered into the food.
It really is.
Yeah.
And the reduction in the environmental footprint provides a crucial transition to the second half of our data stack today.
Because it's not just about us.
No, the plant-forward transition is not merely a strategy for internal vascular health. It is quite literally a mathematical necessity for the physical landmass of the planet.
Right, the EAT Lancet Commission data models the agricultural realities of feeding a projected global population of 10 billion people. And the math regarding our current food system simply does not scale.
The global food system is currently one of the primary drivers of greenhouse gas emissions, freshwater depletion, and land degradation.
It's massive.
And shifting global populations toward plant-forward diets drastically reduces all of those metrics. The core issue is the thermodynamic inefficiency of the current system.
The thermodynamic inefficiency, meaning the energy lost at each step.
Yes. It requires vastly more land, water, and caloric energy to grow crops, transport them, feed those crops to livestock, and then eventually consume the livestock than it does to simply grow crops and feed them directly to humans.
You're cutting out the middleman, basically. But the University College London research introduces a really vital nuance here that we need to mention. It turns out not all plant crops get an automatic pass on sustainability.
That's a very important caveat. The UCL researchers mapped out the pressures our food choices place on local biodiversity,
Right.
and they discovered that scaling up the production of certain highly demanded fruits, vegetables, and nuts, avocados and almonds are prime examples, can exert immense stress on local ecosystems.
Because everyone wants them all year round.
Exactly. These crops often require intensive monoculture farming and rely heavily on vulnerable imported pollinator populations like commercial bee colonies.
Meaning that replacing, say, a locally sourced free-range egg with an avocado shipped across the globe from a water-depleted region is not a guaranteed net win for the environment.
No, it's not. The sourcing of the plants matters just as much as the category itself. Ecological awareness has to be integrated into the transition. It cannot just be a blind substitution of categories.
This brings us to the hardest question of all, honestly. How do we actually execute this transition at scale? Because expecting individual consumers to rely on pure willpower while navigating a grocery store meticulously designed to sell them ultra-processed food is a losing battle.
It's completely unfair to the consumer.
It is. So we looked at a UCL paper analyzing behavioral nudges and this concept of choice architecture.
Yes, choice architecture. It operates on the principle that human beings will reliably take the path of least resistance.
We're fundamentally lazy.
Basically, yeah.
Yeah.
The way choices are physically presented to you heavily influences the decision you will ultimately make. If the easiest, most visible default option is a healthy one, a significant majority of the population will select it simply because it requires zero cognitive effort.
Which brings us right back to the New York City hospital system I mentioned at the start of the deep dive. By implementing a plant-based default policy for patient meals, they completely reversed the traditional choice architecture.
And the absolute brilliance of the NYC model is that it still preserves individual autonomy.
Yes, exactly. Patients can still look at the menu and explicitly opt out. They can request the meatloaf or the chicken. But because the plant-forward meal is the presumptive standard, the hospital drastically increased the consumption of nutrient-dense, fiber-rich foods.
In an environment where people are actively trying to recover from illnesses, I might add.
Many of which are diet-related in the first place. They didn't ban meat. They simply redesigned the path of least resistance.
And we are witnessing this choice architecture scale up to macroeconomic levels now. Denmark, for instance, recently implemented the world's first national plant-based action plan.
Which is fascinating.
Yeah.
And they aren't using a stick, they're using a carrot, right?
Yeah. Exactly. Instead of taxing meat consumption to punish people, the Danish government is utilizing agricultural subsidies to actively build out the supply chain for plant-based foods.
They're funding collaborations.
Yeah, collaborations between culinary professionals and the agricultural sector to make growing crops for human consumption more economically viable for their farmers than growing crops for animal feed.
So it is a systemic supply-side nudge, and it's spreading. Poland is currently moving to guarantee the availability of plant-based meals in public schools and hospitals.
Right.
Meanwhile, the European Union is actively negotiating a comprehensive action plan to establish entirely new crop value chains across the continent.
It is critical, though, to analyze the actual language within these policy documents
Okay.
because whether we are reading the NYC hospital directives or the EU agricultural frameworks, these interventions are framed strictly through the lens of pragmatic efficiency.
That is such an important distinction for our listeners. I want to be really clear here. Based purely on the source text we reviewed, these governments are explicitly deploying these policies as objective tools for public health management, healthcare cost reduction, and carbon efficiency.
Right. It is not an ideological crusade.
Exactly. We aren't taking a side here. We're just reporting what the documents say. They're looking at the compounding financial costs of managing chronic diseases like type 2 diabetes. They're calculating the planetary carbon budget, and they're adjusting their public procurement accordingly.
It is fundamentally about supply chain resilience. If a municipal hospital can lower its food procurement emissions while simultaneously feeding a diabetic patient a meal that actively stabilizes their blood sugar, well, that is just a structural victory for the healthcare system.
It's a win-win. So, synthesizing all of this data, what does the Plan Forward transition actually mean for you, the listener, as you plan your meals for the week? The prevailing takeaway from the clinical science, the environmental models, and the behavioral psychology is that you do not need to join some elite, all-or-nothing dietary club.
No, the objective is simply to manipulate the dimmer switch.
Precisely. It's about actively turning up the dial on whole, intact foods, the actual lentils, the whole oats, the leafy greens, to protect the endothelial lining of your blood vessels, stave off oxidative stress in your brain, and reduce your overall planetary footprint.
And simultaneously, it requires maintaining a very high level of skepticism toward the ultra-processed marketing machine that's trying to sell you a lab-engineered isolate as a health food.
Yes, read the labels.
Always. The value of this research lies entirely in its application, and the application can start microscopically. You do not need to overhaul your entire pantry today. The American Heart Association data suggests it can be as simple as consistently swapping butter for olive oil, or maybe incorporating just one heavily legume-based meal a week to increase your fiber intake and, honestly, stretch your grocery budget.
It is the accumulation of those tiny nudges that actually rewires your health.
Mm.
But I want to leave you with a final thought to ponder, building on the behavioral shifts we just explored in those major institutions.
Okay.
If the largest public hospitals in the country and entire European nations are actively redesigning their menus to make plants the default standard of dining, how long will it be until the traditional meat-heavy dinner plate is no longer viewed as an everyday necessity, but rather as a nostalgic luxury?
That's a profound question.
Something akin to a decadent dessert, you know, reserved for special occasions rather than a random Tuesday night. It is definitely something to chew on the next time you are standing in the grocery aisle looking at your options. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive.